The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is AARP. Annual sponsors include Northwest Nazarene University, Red Sky, and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum on civility is Kevin Richard.
My name's Kevin Richard. I'm a writer with Idaho Education News, and I'm also a member of the City Club Board of Directors, and I want to welcome you all here this afternoon. I want to thank our media sponsors who help make events like today's forum possible: Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI Radio, and Peppershock Media. I want to especially welcome, we have 100 students here today from Capitol High School. Not to pander, but I'm proud. I'm a Capitol dad, and it's really, really cool to see so many of you here. And I want to thank Jeff Tucker from Public Television and Chris Taylor from the Boise School District for helping to get you all here. You know, it's not lost on any of us, I think, what's going on today at the State House and across the country. There are about 2,000 students, from what I see on Twitter, at the Idaho State House today, making their voices heard about school safety. And as I read my Twitter feed a few minutes ago while we were all eating and getting ready, I was struck by a couple of things that I saw on my Twitter feed. I saw a tweet from Betsy Russell, the reporter from the Spokane Spokesman Review, the State House reporter, speaking to House Speaker Scott Bedke about the student demonstrations. And he went out of his way to compliment the students for being respectful, making their point, and getting their voices heard, but doing it in a mature manner. And I look elsewhere on my Twitter feed, and I see a Twitter shouting match going on between the Bonneville County Democratic Party Twitter account and the Idaho Republican Party Twitter account about assault rifles and gun control, a dialogue that I am sure is going to change about zero minds. And as I read all of that, it's all anecdotal, but it strikes me that maybe we adults might learn a thing or two from you all and how you are conducting yourselves. So we'll try to be civil for the next hour and get things started. You have seen all three of these fine speakers in the video, so there's really very little that I need to do by way of introduction, but I'm going to work my way down the row here from my immediate left onward. I'm going to start with Bill Manny. Bill and I, we've been fellow journalists, colleagues for 15 years. And friends. We're very civil. We get along great. I wanted to get your vantage point. I want to get all three of your respective vantage points on this issue of civility and what you've seen in this turbulent past couple of years and how it's affected your life, your profession. Bill, why don't I start with you, and we'll go to Michelle and Richard from there.
With the microphone, as I have with the video, apparently. So I'm a journalist and an editor and a columnist. And so I have that's one circle of my life. And then I have this other kind of civic circle in my involvement in City Club. And then I'm working with Cindy Wilson and Chris Taylor and Russ Heller and Don Coberly and Seth Ashley and Justin Vaughn. I've really gotten interested in education. And so I've kind of come to the conclusion that we have these three circles, that I have these three circles in my life, and they overlap. And where all three of them overlap, journalism and civic engagement and education, is the place I need to be. As I see what's happening in our country, journalism by itself is not solving it, and civility by itself is not solving it, and education by itself is not solving it. But maybe if we can combine all those impulses, you know, the better angels of our nature, and think about where that intersection is, that, I think, is the key to our future. And so that's why I'm excited to see so many young people here and so many students here and faculty and teachers thinking and engaging on this, because, you know, my generation isn't setting a very good example. And I think that the next generations have a chance to get right what we got wrong. And so that's what I've learned, and that's the point I would like to make. I'd also like to thank Cindy Wilson and Chris Taylor and Richard Newman and Michelle Chadwick and Seth Ashley, who's also here, and the students from the Boise State Civility Research Network who are here for participating in this project and also for setting such good examples. Thank you.
Michelle, you've seen this as an elected official and now a former elected official who now works more in public policy consulting.
Right.
From your vantage point, how do you put into perspective what we're seeing right now, what we've seen these past couple of turbulent years?
Yeah, the last couple of years have been tough. It's been tough to be an American. I mean, how many of you really associate and own that you're an American first, as opposed to a Republican or a Democrat or an Independent or a Libertarian? We're Americans, and we really share more in common than we fight about. And yet our time is spent arguing over important issues, but in such an unkind and unhelpful way. As you saw in my piece, I have no problem with someone arguing or disagreeing with my policies, my politics, but when you go after a person's kid, that's a line. And so whenever I'm online, and I'm on Facebook, I'm on social media a lot, my role is to try and find some respect. And if I know that someone out there is talking about fake news, and yet they're the one that has maybe some inaccurate information, is to respectfully let them know, not in a public venue, but in a quiet, respectful manner, hey, you might want to double check that fact, because I think if you go here, you might find something different. And I'm from Gem County, Emmett. We just had our school bond went down yesterday. Right. Man, there were some uncivil conversations online about the need for a school bond. And all we can do is try and find our way together, because I'm not gonna make it by myself. You're not going to make it by yourself, but together as Americans, as Idahoans, we will, and we have to, because what's our choice? And so we have to find a way to tamper down that anger and the disrespect and have those good conversations. I'm a Republican. Some of my best friends are Democrats. And together we joke that we can solve the world's problems because we talk. And I don't have all the answers. My friend Linda doesn't have all the answers. But when we talk, we find some amazing, incredible solutions to problems.
Okay, Michelle, I'm going to stay with you for a second. I'll get to you, Richard, in a moment, but I can't resist. A school bond issue. Now, I cover school bond issues,
right.
So I'm fairly
yeah.
passionate about them, but that's an occupational
yeah.
hazard. A school bond issue is not a debate over gun control or abortion. It shouldn't be a hot button issue. Why was that a hot button issue in your community? And what does that say about the larger issue of civility if we can't even have a civil conversation
about civility against the bond?
Well, so we have three factions in our community. We have the yes votes. We have the folks that believe you go and you support the kids, no questions asked. You have the no votes that wanted more in the bond. And then you have the no, I own property, I own a farm, and I don't think that I should have
the
to
know
pay.
How, no way.
The no think. Way, no how.
Okay.
But the biggest interesting part I found in this, and because I'm a policy geek, I get property tax, is that a lot of the folks that were voting no, because they don't want to support a bond, because it's on my property tax, they don't understand what the system used to be when it was a part of the property tax system. One of our problems in society right now, I think, is we have no sense of place, we have no sense of history. And if you don't know what's happened before, you can't understand what's happening today. So one gentleman whom I know and I deeply love, voted no. And he went on this rant on Facebook about how it shouldn't be on the property tax, and yet how was it funded before when we passed our last bond? And how were
on
the property tax. And so, you know, when I see that, where it's such a strong belief based in utter fantasy, that's when you get to dance around providing a history lesson in a very respectful manner. And so we haven't done a good enough job of explaining how we fund certain parts of government and what the role of government really is. And I think that is something that we all can do a better job, is learning what the role of government is, what the role of government isn't, and understanding the different levels and layers of government and who should pay what. So what should be on your property tax, and who gets to decide what goes on your property tax? Does everybody know that? Because most people don't. And what your income tax pays for at the state, what does it pay for? And at the federal level, what does it pay for? Totally different stuff. And so if you don't know that, it's really easy to get angry. And then, like, some folks run for office, they think commissioner, you know, in my world, county commissioner is like all that, and it is. But you know, if you're mad at the school, at the way the schools are, don't run for county commissioner, because I didn't have a thing to do with the schools. I didn't get to figure out which teacher got fired or, you know, which playground equipment was the best. I ran the weed department and the road department and the mosquito department. You know, you got to know what you're doing and what level of government gets to play in which sandbox.
So Richard Newman, president of the City Club, you've been president of this club as we've kind of embarked on this journey to promote civility. And I'm curious, maybe talk about what you've seen the past couple of years, not just from the vantage point as a volunteer board president, but maybe how it intersects with your personal world, your professional world. Give us your observations.
So one way that it intersects with your personal life is when something like that happens and everybody patiently waits for you to figure out the mic. So thank you for that. It was interesting. I'm going to start a little bit with the City Club because I think it was a chance to kind of focus on a little bit, but I'll take it a little bit further. When we were first talking about civility and whether we wanted to do the civility project, you say something like that. Remember, the backdrop was 2014, 2015 when we're starting to think about 2016. And so looking at one another and going, hey, we should, you know, think about doing a project and give the club some center. And civility is one of our hallmarks, is one of the things that we're centered around. And then you say that, and then you look at it, we're going to talk about civility? I mean, it's not the sort of thing that you first think of, hey, that's something I want to go spend a Friday night at, right? And we didn't want it to turn into one of those eat your vegetables sorts of conversations. You know, we everything you need to know about civility you learned in kindergarten. Treat people decent, and treat them like you'd want to be treated. It's the golden rule. And so, okay, so what are we going to do this about? And when you start thinking about it, you start realizing, and we had just come through the midterms. It was still the second term of President Obama's in office, and the campaign for the 2016 presidential campaign hadn't really started in earnest unless you were really following the news. And when you try to get a hold of it, what does it really mean? And you break it down into the sorts of things like respect, integrity, reciprocity. There's also courage. And when I think of the groups that I manage in technology and building software to send it out into the world, I wouldn't hire people that don't want to be civil with one another. It is a huge thing in the business, into an office, when you're building a team, that people can work together. And you don't choose the people that are like you. You choose the people that can get the job done. Your focus is on being able to get something useful to happen. And so we don't tolerate incivility in the groups that we work with. We call that out. We try to change the cultures that go on there. And it's an object lesson on why do we tolerate that in the ways that we interact with one another when we're not there. And part of it is the lack of humanity. Now, the one place that you will see uncivil behavior if you're not thinking about it is how you talk to yourself in your head when you're driving the car on the freeway and somebody cuts you off. And at that moment, you don't have the most civil thoughts in your head, or a lot of times you don't, unless you're much better behaved than I am. And the reason that that kind of stays contained is you don't share it in the moment, but you've dehumanized the person in the other car. That's just now a car that cut you off. Well, the same thing's happening on the internet or any of these other situations. You've now taken them out of that human interaction, and you've made them some just conversation that you don't really see the person behind it. And so that first thing of realizing that the people that you're interacting with, those people that you've put a red jersey on or a blue jersey on, or you've somehow made them different, is because you didn't take the time to get out of the car, shake their hand, and say, did I do something wrong? So that when I think about how it intersects personal life, I think about how I work with other people in professional settings. It just, you wouldn't go there. Okay.
So while I wait for and encourage you to turn in questions, and please just hold up your hand when you have a question card filled out, we will get the questions up here. I really want to hear what you all want to know. But I want to stay with something, and I'll start with you, Richard, because this is a conversation that we had internally as an organization when we embarked on this project, and it's the challenge of defining not only what is civility, but what does civility not entail? And what I'm getting at here is sort of the tension between civil discourse and allowing space for disagreement. And that was something we debated about a lot. We wrangled about a lot. Let's talk about that a little bit from your perspective, and we'll work our way back down the row to Michelle and Bill.
Yeah, the civility gets wrapped up in all sorts of other terms. It got talked about a little bit in the video and a couple other places. If you look up in the dictionary, you see civility heavily equated with politeness. And I don't think that's really true. Politeness is how you signal your intent to be civil to another person. It is a way to indicate that you intend to engage with somebody else and that you want to demonstrate that you intend to do so with respect. And so you follow those sort of politeness and etiquette around it in order to make sure you have that happening. And if you're in a courtroom, you follow a certain protocol too, because the participants there are deliberately adversarial, and they even more so have to follow a protocol. So when you talk about politeness and civility, it's really easy to combine the two concepts. The other problem with civility is it can be weaponized. And what I mean by that is sometimes civility gets used as a trump card. Oh, we can't talk about that. That's an uncivil conversation, and that's not something that we can really do, and you're not being nice by bringing that topic up. Or incivility obviously gets weaponized as well. But whenever you use civility that way, you've taken away the idea of the respect and the integrity and that sort of reciprocity, that ability to put it on the table and actually wrestle with what needs to be done. If somebody brings up the topic and feels it's worth being talked about, you're disrespecting them by not at least giving it some room to go. So looking at civility as a context which enables a constructive conversation about disagreement, bringing that in so you can wrestle with the hard stuff with somebody you know, you'll never change their mind, because that's not your purpose. You're not intending to change their mind. You're intending to have a conversation to find the common ground. And if you can use civility for that, you've actually turned it in a constructive way to be able to move forward.
Michelle, you talked about it a little bit before, the tension between trying to discuss policy matters where there is disagreement, where there may be controversy, and doing it in a manner that's still civil.
So one of the things that I always tried to do is recognize that my intentions were pure, and I try not to assume on behalf of anyone else, but that was one thing where I would, is that I'm coming to a discussion with a pure motive. My assumption is that whoever I'm engaging with also while passionate and we may or may not agree on the topic, also wants what's best for our county, our city, our community. And if you start in that place where we both want what's best, I don't necessarily need to convince anyone that I'm right. It's not about being right. It's about what's best for our community and best for that situation or understanding of a topic. And if you can't start in a place where I respect you and I respect the issue, then you'll never move forward and you'll never be able to process and learn from that other person. And that's, if you can't do that, that is, you're missing out on life. Because you're not going to be able to, we're all lifetime learners. And whether I want to learn more about gun control or what an assault rifle is or isn't, it's going to be part of our lives. It's going to be part of our conversation. And I need to know what that is, whether I agree, whatever side I'm on. That's information that I'm going to want or, and need to have. So I'm going to want to engage with someone that may or may not share my core belief, because that's important information for me to have. And I think that we have to respect each other, again, as people, as humans, as Americans, as Idahoans, to get to where we can have those conversations. Again, whether we agree when we start or when we finish, but we need to be able to have an ability to learn from each other. And that hasn't been happening.
So, Bill Manny, your job as a columnist is by nature going to be an adversarial job. I mean, you're going to say things that some people will agree with and some people will disagree with. It's an adversarial job, or so I've heard. How do you strike that balance, knowing that what you write will set some people off?
That's really tough, and I'll be the first to admit that I don't always get it right. And I would also be the first to admit that most good journalists will admit that they don't always get it right. And what's the line between calling someone out for constructive, if tough, criticism and making fun of someone or mocking someone? There's a fine line there. I think we all know that it's valuable and worth honoring. I think we would all disagree on where it is. And I have just in the last few weeks been accused both of being uncivil and unkind and implying that Idaho legislators are stupid and immoral, which I did not mean to imply. And on the other hand, I've been accused of enabling and excusing because I wasn't tough enough on the same group of Idaho legislators with whom this person thought I should be tougher. And how does one offer that kind of constructive criticism and remain part of the conversation? Because if you marginalize yourself by name calling or mockery, then you're not going to persuade. So I would be the first to admit that it's hard and I don't always get it right. But it's a really important line that especially a writer and a columnist and an editorial person has to observe. Can I make one point about the civility question that you asked my colleagues? Adam Davis, who did the session just before this down the hall, executive director of the Oregon Humanities, he asked his son what the term civility meant. And his son said, being polite. And that's kind of what the rich people up on the hill do. And so this notion that politeness is something that privileged people do and also is a way that privileged people hold unprivileged people down is really important to me. And I really worry about that. And so I think when we talk about civility, that's not what I mean, and that's why I've started using the term civic literacy, right? Because it's engaging and conversing and educating and listening, and that's not always implied by the term civility. So I think sometimes the term itself turns people off.
So it's another fine line, the fine line between promoting civility but also welcoming voices to the table rather than trying to keep voices getting heard or being at the table. We've got some really good questions here, and I'm just going to start to plow through as many of them as we can get to. And this is a really good one, so I'm going to start here. How can we express intolerance of incivility and still be civil? For example, can we call a racist a racist? I'd extend that to say, can you call a liar a liar?
You just do it. Yeah.
Okay.
But you don't do it publicly. You don't go on Facebook and say, Bill Manny, you're such an idiot. What are you thinking? You know, you don't do that.
But truth is a defense.
Well, you know. I mean, if I had an issue with Bill and I felt, you know, I'm reading his editorial and I'm using this example, a racist. Okay, I'm not going to get on Facebook and call him out and say, I really think you're a racist. I'm going to go to Bill. I'm going to email him, or since I know him, I'm going to pick up the phone and call him and say, this is how I'm taking this. I know who you are. I don't think this is how you probably meant it, but if you did, can we have a conversation? I mean, you got it. A lot of it, I think we have to learn to take the emotion out of the conversations and again, not assume about someone else. But talk about the issue, which is, this is how I'm interpreting your column. I'm not assuming that that's what you meant, but if it is, we need to talk, and we need more dialogue.
But you can't. You don't get to talk to Donald Trump. You don't get to call him up and say, "I think I misunderstood what you meant about this."
What,
these
what
actresses.
Makes you think that? I said I was a Republican. So, no, just kidding.
So the implication is, if you're not calling him out as a racist or a misogynist, you're excusing or enabling. So, and I think that's kind of the heart of this question.
But to my Republican friends who think he walks on water, I do say, you know, some of the things that he has done, I've experienced. I've experienced some of those, you know, bus episodes as an elected official. And I know what that means. And I do call that out to my friends who think that that's okay. And I personalize it for them and I color it. It's not black and white for me. There's a lot of color involved in that. And so I try and explain where they can look at me and I can look at them and explain what that means when he says something or he does something, because it's not just words. There's a behavior that's behind that. And you may like his politics or his policies, and there's a lot of people out there that do and support his reduction in regulations. No problem with that. But when you like his tweets and you send them on and you add your little woohoo to it, think about what that says about you. Because who he's tweeting about, as I said in the piece, that's somebody's mom or dad or son or daughter, brother, sister. That's not just, hey, Rex Tillerson, you're out. You know, I don't know Rex. I don't know his family.
But you're on a first name basis.
Why not? But somebody is.
Right. No.
And the whole 6 degrees of separation, I may know someone that does know him. And somebody's got to say, no, it's not okay. So why shouldn't it be me? Why shouldn't I be the first one to say, I'm sorry, that's not okay. It's not okay in my world. And so please don't let it be okay in yours. And maybe the person I say that to will then hear that and take it. And maybe they'll be the second person.
You're talking about criticizing behavior, not labeling someone as an X or a Y, right? It's the behavior rather than the person.
But you have to do both. You have to do both. Can't do one or the other.
So this all ties in really well to this question. Shouting hateful things wins elections, especially party primary elections. And as long as that is the case, as long as that holds true, what are our hopes of having a more respectful political process at the end?
Well, I'll take that on. I mean, I think the response is in this room. I mean, we allow that to persuade us. It's up to us to say, I'm not going to accept that. You do not win my vote by attacking or criticizing. And I think we have a generation, my kids and younger, are recognizing that you have to be smarter than that. So don't get played and don't get manipulated. That's easy to say, and I know it's cliche, and I know it's not going to win an election tomorrow. But I think we have to decide as a society that that is not the way we reward politicians.
I'm going to jump in on that. It is, again, we generally as individuals know what we should do. We know that that's good for us. The difficulty, of course, is that you're talking about a larger group of people, and not everybody that's voting in elections is necessarily in this room, because they want to hear about civility and making those kinds of decisions. Part of the nature of incivility is it starts excluding people. I do not want to be a part of hearing a bunch of people shouting at one another. And you have this sense of, I've got better things to do with my time, that is not something I want to be a part of, and they just close down. And we talk about voting rates, we talk about being engaged in civil dialogue, being engaged in your community. That takes a special kind of courage, especially when the tenor of the conversation is the way it is. In Michelle's case, being with even at a county commissioner level and dealing with the local community there, the fact that she had to endure that sort of thing, people coming up to her and her kids in stores and saying things, I mean, how much courage would that take for you to be able to stand up there and continue to go back to work the next day knowing that's what you're going to deal with? So the idea of looking at what you'd be voting on, looking at what is going to what's happening in politics today, and then wanting to ever identify yourself with being a part of that, takes a certain amount of willingness to do what you were saying of, no, that's not okay in my world. And part of the courage for the people that want more civility to happen and spread out is not only by increasing the awareness, talking about civility as a value. I mean, it's not a word you generally talk about at a dinner table, right? But talking about that as a value in your family and respect and things of that, and bringing up awareness and then modeling it. Being able to use it with the courage to talk to somebody and say, you know, there was a kinder way you could have said that, or there's another way you could handle it, or this is another way we can think about it, and think about your friend Rex or what have you, his family, and how he's taking it. Being able to model that in front of other people helps them see that's the way that behave and help them with the courage to do the same thing. It's not enough for us individually to want to be more civil. We have to create the context with everyone else that we interact with and promote that. We have to make it kind of cool to be that way.
For our radio audience, you're listening to a City Club of Boise Forum Beyond Civility. We're joined by Bill Manny, Michelle Chadwick, and Richard Newman. So I started this hour citing some incivility that I saw in my Twitter feed, which is low-hanging fruit. I mean, I don't like to work that hard, so it's easy for me to find examples of incivility on my Twitter feed. But this questioner asks a good question that maybe looks at the internet from a different vantage point, and I wanted to ask you all to weigh in on this. Do you feel like the internet has helped new generations become more understanding about beliefs and religions and other differences between people?
That's probably a question for Seth Ashley or Corey Cook, but I a little bit I do know is that Seth told me when we were doing the interview for the video that people roughly spend the same amount of time with a screen. The people who seek out new and contrary information are less likely to be polarized. They're more likely to be engaged. They're more likely to feel that they have a role in society. So I think it can be a positive experience. It all depends on how you interact with it.
One of the things that I think we talk about social media and we talk about how incivil it can be. And certainly that's easy to find. But I think there's some remarkable places in social media and some common places you wouldn't think about where very strong civility is demonstrated, where people that don't know one another are supporting one another, and they're doing it in fairly open situations with some fairly personal truths. It's just a different form of communication. And you're going to run into... But the thing that makes me happy is when I see other people go, you know, that's just not what we do in this channel. I'm not happy with that. And you've got whatever, the 300 participants in the conversation. You know you probably got 3,000 lurkers seeing that being reacted to, helping model that behavior as seeing that conversation going on. So I don't think that the internet may make it faster. It may make it more visible. I don't know that the tenor of the conversation changes to what it would have been before the internet.
Well, I've been struck, too, watching the past 4 weeks, the flattening of the world through Twitter. The students of Parkland have had a voice in the national debate over school safety and gun control that the survivors of Columbine 20 years ago did not have. So there's this opportunity. With that opportunity comes some challenges, though. That's a question kind of disguising itself as a statement. But
So the other thing that my professor friends told me when we were doing the research on that is that people who get their information from cable news, whether it's left or right, are much more likely to be dug in than people who get their information from websites, tend to be younger, tend to be more open-minded, tend to be more flexible. So I think there's lots of things that are troubling about social media and discouraging, but I think there are also opportunities and reasons to be encouraged.
So in January, I had the good fortune to be back in D.C. and went to the press club. And one of the conversations that we had was, you know, you're not going to learn anything new if you watch cable news. You're not going to miss a big story. And so turn it off. And that really struck me. And then the next sentence was, because they really are great about camouflaging reporters and editorial staff and mixing them so that just the casual viewer may or may not know who is a straight news reporter versus who's throwing their slant on it. And so again, because they do that, another reason to turn off cable and go to the news sources that you know are trustworthy, research, and take out a subscription to your local newspaper. That's what they're saying in D.C. So I was like, yay, Bill! But it's true, because if you're seeing a story that you're not sure about, or you don't agree with, Bill's right here and you can talk to him about it.
No, we could spend an hour talking about media literacy. The 30-second version of it is pay attention to where you're getting your information from and look into the source of it rather before jumping to conclusions on the basis of it. A couple of people asked about memes. And are memes ever a form of civil communication? And can they be used in a civil dialogue? Michelle,
I'm not a fan. I guess it depends on the forum. I mean, if I see a really funny meme, and everybody has their favorites, and I send it to, you know, some of my friends, they're going to know the vein in which I'm sending it. That's, I think, the key, is what's that motivation that's behind it. I'm not going to throw it on Facebook and say that Bill Manny's a racist. I'm not going to do that, because memes don't have that built-in respect, and you can't describe what our relationship is. I mean, if I that's part of it too, is you may not know that if I'd say something to Bill, he's going to totally understand the context that I'm sending it, But Kevin may not understand that. So he may take it in a completely different manner than what I'm sending it and what Bill's receiving it.
It's interesting to think about our reaction to memes, and yet I publish editorial cartoons every day in the newspaper, which are basically bigger versions.
The original meme.
Right, the original meme. And they are harsh, right? I mean, these guys draw in black and white and then red for blood because they draw blood. And so – but you see it on a newspaper editorial page. You understand the context, and you understand that over time you're going to get a selection of a variety of opinion, you know. So I guess I'm less bothered by memes just as an art form. I think it's like any other online comment. It's either respectful or on point or funny, or it's disrespectful, and I think it all depends on the context.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to switch gears because I really love this question. I wanted to make sure we got to it. When NFL players kneel to protest police violence against black men, are they being civil? Richard wants to start. He's got a smile. He wants to start.
Yeah, this is a safe question. The two sides of that are you making your point in a civil manner? Are you being disrespectful to another person? And, of course, the other side of that is, are you disrespecting, say, the national anthem or the flag or what have you? Now, think about the variety of responses that a player could do if they wanted to make that point, or anybody in a particular profession wanted to do to make that point. You could walk up and try to put your finger in someone's chest and yell loudly in their face. You could go off and sulk and not say anything. You could go off and write blazing editorials. Part of the, and this goes with a number of different protests, and you know, you could even talk about whether you're walking out of schools, whether you're doing marches down the street, at what point are protests civil and uncivil? Part of what makes a particular protest civil is if they are making their point and doing it in a way to be heard without necessarily imposing on the people around them. Are you doing something that gives it visibility? Because if I don't give it visibility, I'm not calling out the issue we need to discuss. On the other hand, if I do it in a way that's in your face and somehow being assaultive or disrespectful, I'm not doing it either. So, by that definition, I'd argue that taking a knee in front of the cameras in their profession is not disrespectful with regard to the people around them. Whether or not you judge it disrespectful to the national anthem would be your perspective on how far we can take that and how you view the idea of whether the flag or the national anthem represents the ability to make protests and to be heard about issues that you disagree with, or whether it is some sort of you're never supposed to use that in the context of whatever you're dealing with. But in terms of that particular action, I don't think they're doing that. That's being disrespectful to the people.
My reaction is I understand why people find it disrespectful, and I understand why it makes those people angry. And I think someone who engages in that protest needs to understand the reaction they're going to get. I mean, that's why the students, civil rights activists, sat at the lunch counter. They understood the reaction they were going to get. And I think, I guess if you're mindful and you're deliberate, it's one thing. If you're not thinking about the reaction you expect, it's another. But it seems to me it's a modern version of sitting at the lunch counter. And that's civil disobedience, and it's an action that someone is taking in order to produce a positive outcome.
And it seems like it all gets to something we've already kind of discussed a little bit, but I wanted to maybe go back to a little bit, the tension between civility and listening and accommodating and encouraging new voices into the conversation. I mean, one questioner asks, to what extent are you willing to go to make everyone in our city feel appreciated and equal and important?
You know, we did this activity this morning where we talked to somebody about an experience you recently had. And so I talked about going to the Civility Research Network the Honors College has this conversation. It's this really cool group of students at Boise State, and diversity of every kind. And I'm the old white guy in that room. And I thought, I need to be here, and I need to be listening to this, and I need to be hearing these things, because if I'm not hearing that, I'm missing a really important part of the conversation. And I'm really impressed with the way they found a way to have really tough conversations, even angry conversations, without expressing anger. And I felt welcome, and I felt like this is a place where more people need to be, and there are more people who need to be hearing this conversation.
I think we all have to commit individually that we're going to listen to folks that we don't agree with. We have to make ourselves uncomfortable and put ourselves in situations and with others that we otherwise may not naturally come into contact with, and listen and show respect and be willing to grow as people and understand that we don't have all the answers, and whomever else that we're going to interact with, again, comfortable or not comfortable conversations and interactions, we should be open to learning from those and listening.
And it kind of leads to this, which feels like kind of a yeah, but question. But, and so I'm going to ask it as a yeah, but when you're interacting with a person and they choose not to be civil, they choose to be disruptive or ignorant to what you're trying to say, how do you proceed? How do you work through that? How do you continue to speak civilly and try to change the dialogue as one person in that dialogue?
That sounds like a Richard question. Mm-hmm. I will just say, you know, I work at a newspaper, and we get angry phone calls, and I will listen to someone who's upset. I've decided I'm not gonna let myself be the subject of abuse, right? So if someone wants to call me and talk to me in a respectful way, I will converse with them in an equally respectful way. If they're gonna yell at me or abuse me or call me 11 times a week, I'm gonna stop, because it's not worth my time or my anguish to do that. So I think we are obligated to extend respect to others, and if it's and at some point it's not reciprocated, I don't think you're obligated.
Yeah, so I'm kind of drawing back on, kind of goes back to what I said earlier, thinking about how you deal with things in professional settings. I agree absolutely. You're going to set some boundaries. I mean, there's certain things that I'm just not going to tolerate being in my life for very long, but there are situations where the person that you're dealing with is actually going through something difficult, and they're just doing a poor job of expressing it. Part of it is going, we're going to be able to get to some resolution better if we can slow down and actually make this a conversation. And part of it has to do with what they're trying to accomplish. Remember, there's this notion of, can we weaponize the conversation in a certain way? Am I talking to you and making my point because I want to because I have an audience and I need them to see that I'm giving you the what for, versus am I just trying to have a conversation and work it out with you, but I'm coming at it from a place of anger or, you know, just poor conversation skills or what have you? If it's a person that's just really excited and they're interrupting you and they're not giving you a chance to speak, yeah, that's not real respectful either, but it's coming from a different place and you work through it. If it's two people out in the field having fingers in one another's chest, you know, that's obviously you got to draw some boundaries there. If the person that's angry and interrupting you all the time has an audience, that's probably the time you go, I think I'm serving as a foil for the point you want to make in front of your friends. And so dealing with that, say, in professional situations, you have some ability to go ahead and control the conversation, go, we're going to end this conversation and we're going to move on. And if you want to come back and talk to us about it in a more respectful tone, we can resume there, or we're just going to end the relationship. But in other cases, you work through that and find a way to get that person to another place so you can find that common ground you're trying to seek.
And I think the way that you can get that conversation started is by asking the other person questions. Find out why they are so angry, passionate, what they are bringing to the conversation. I agree with Bill. One of my rules is if somebody starts swearing at me on the phone, I that's a value for me that I don't share that. So I'll say, you know, I appreciate this conversation that we're having, but I can't have you swear at me again, or I'm going to hang up. I warn them, and if they continue to swear at me, then I hang up. But if somebody is doing the audience, then I would make an appointment with them to have that conversation later, outside of their friends. If they are passionate, angry, needing to just vent, it's okay. I have big shoulders. I can let somebody vent on me. If we need to engage, I let the tone come and try and tamper it down a little bit, because eventually they're going to get tired or run out of breath. And then ask more. It's all about asking the right questions and finding out what it is that I think the issue is, but maybe maybe I'm reading it wrong. And again, trying to learn from that person. And I may not learn anything, but I at least owe that person the respect. That's my value. They may not deserve the respect, but I think that if they want to engage with me on some level, I owe them that respect to listen, at least at first, mm-hmm. to see where the conversation is going to go to.
Well, let's talk about listening on the other end of it, because somewhere between the person who is swearing, who mm-hmm. has clearly crossed the line, and the person on the other extreme, on the other end, who is really engaged, who is really going to have a conversation with you that can be fruitful, that can be useful, is the person who really isn't listening.
That's not my deal. That's their deal. I can't control somebody else's reaction and response, but I can do what's best for me, and I can try and provide information. Whether they decide to take it or not, that I can't control that. Mm-hmm. I can do what's best in providing honesty and respect and integrity to them, and hopefully we can move to a place where that conversation may not start out respectful, but we may be able to get to a place. And sometimes it takes a long time, but you got to get there. You have to try.
You know, I'm reminded of that the Sarah Silverman tweet where this guy was being really abusive to her, and instead of turning him off, she said, "I hear you." And she did some research and found out that he was going through this horrible thing in his life, and she went above and beyond. I'm not sure I could do that. And now they're colleagues or they have this relationship, and she's helping him get mental health care. So there is a way to do that, and maybe we just need more examples of how we do it, because I'm not sure I'm a very good practitioner at it.
For our radio audience, you're listening to a City Club of Boise Forum, Beyond Civility, a discussion on civil discourse. I'm joined by Bill Manny, Michelle Chadwick, and Richard Newman. We're at that point in the hour where I've got probably about 2 hours worth of questions and 10 minutes to cover them, which is a good thing. I appreciate all these questions. They're great. I kind of want to start where I started a little bit, talking about the events of the day at the State House and across the country, and get your thoughts about what we're seeing happening with the student demonstrations today. And from your perspective, how does that conversation continue from here? How do students and teachers and administrators continue the conversation or build on the conversation?
Walking out by itself creates visibility of just how passionate the students feel about the issue. It brings an opportunity to say we're disrupting the common way that things work so that we stop and pay attention to why we're walking out. The obvious response to that is then pay attention. Sit down, have a conversation, do a forum like this, do something where you get a group of people and you put the issues out on the table and say, what are some ways we can talk about it? The reason in this particular case why that walking out has come to this, where students feel they have to disrupt the school day in order to make the point, is because there doesn't seem to be us coming together to do that. The courage that is involved is having the various people that we know are going to disagree, being willing to sit down, listen to one another, and not necessarily have their mind changed, but be open to that they might see an opportunity. Remember, I talked about audience before. The courage for the participants in that conversation is to be willing in front of their audience to listen and to seek where that common ground might be so the conversation can start. That is a huge amount of courage for the people involved. When you think about, like at the Stimson Award, we talked about Congressman Mike Simpson and Rick Johnson with the Idaho Conservation League. There was a huge amount of courage on both of those fellows' part because they knew how their constituencies would react to them sitting down and talking to one another. So how do we get those folks that need to come together and have that conversation in the same room? Have a way to do that. That's what the walking out is signaling needs to happen. It's not enough to walk out. Now a conversation needs to happen.
So, Michelle Chadwick, you're a policy wonk. You confessed policy wonk. How do you see that process going from the awareness raising, and maybe that's a disruptive process sometimes, to a process that, you know, brings people to the table to discuss policy differences, areas of policy agreement?
You just do it. We just do it. And for the kids that walked out of school, they get to learn the rules of civic engagement and how does a bill become a law and learn their passion and their energy and their voice is very powerful in and of itself. But then when you put it within the confines of working within the system as it is, that's part of the process. We have to help them understand how to make change in the way that the system works right now. Those are the rules and that we have right now. They may be fair, they may not be fair, but that's how it is right now. So we need to steer them in a direction where what they want to show them and educate them how to get to that next step and then next step and the next step. Because we traditionally have not done a good job on civic and education. It just hasn't happened. And until we get to that point where people understand how a bill becomes a law, we're going to get stuck at the talking stage.
Bill?
I'm just excited that we're at a moment where we have a generation of kids, young people, activists who don't know that they're just supposed to sit still and be quiet. The lobby, the decision makers, the industry doesn't want to change the way we deal with guns or any other subject. They don't have that inculcated, and so they're willing. They want to push beyond the bounds, and I think they're also going to learn the cost of that, right? If you end up being suspended or you have to go to version of detention in modern school, but they're going to learn the cost of activism. But I'm impressed by this notion that they don't know that they're just supposed to sit still and be quiet. What we see in the Boise School District, this new curriculum aimed at civic literacy has been developed with input from students in the Boise School District. And what Dr. Custer talked about, what's happening on campus is being directed by students who recognize that the way things work right now don't work. And so I'm really excited that we have a group of people who aren't accepting the status quo.
So we have a couple of minutes left, and I want to ask all three of you to maybe talk about an aha moment along the way here. I mean, we've spent the past couple of years here in City Club dealing with this, and maybe my aha moment was when I was taken to task by a couple of journalists on their podcast, good friends of mine, who said, well, civility is a wonderful thing, but you don't want it to turn into something that suppresses voices. You don't want it to become a civil way of telling people to shut up. And it was really, it was an aha moment coming from two people who I like and respect that made me think about where this, how this works and how it ought to work. And I'm wondering if, in the time left, give us sort of a lesson that you've learned all, along the way here these past couple of years that has sort of resonated and stuck with you.
You know, when we were talking about the, I've been leading teams for, I don't know, 20 years or 25 years professionally, and generally pushing toward, you know, a culture of teamwork and being able to get things done. But I hadn't really thought too much about the word civility in a deep way until, of course, the City Club was working through the Civility Project. And it was that sort of word that, yeah, we all know we're supposed to do it, and we generally know what that looks like and so forth. I started to appreciate, I think the aha moment for me was thinking about the fact that it's not easy when everyone else around you isn't practicing it. You kind of get that sort of, well, you're doing it to look good, or you're doing it because there kind of goes back to the privilege thing or what have you. The notion that it sometimes takes courage to look somebody else in the eye and I know I don't agree with you, but I want to see what you have to say, and I'm willing to be vulnerable to the fact you might change my mind. Or I'm willing to do this while the people that want me to feel a certain way, am I betraying how they look at me? I think that element of courage surprised me. I hadn't appreciated it being there.
Michelle.
So my aha moment was actually with Bill when he was filming me for this the film, and I'm just, you know, blah 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 like I usually do, and he kind of stopped me when he said, he goes, say that again, and I said, well, as an elected official, you're somebody's mom or brother or sister, you know, and the look on his face was, I had personalized a title that for me, I was just always Michelle. I wasn't Commissioner, you know, at the time, Scheer. I wasn't Commissioner Scheer. And I told people, never call me that, because that was this person, that was something out here. I was Michelle, and if you had to use the title, it was Commissioner Michelle. And because that was really important to me, that I had an amazing, awesome job. It wasn't much different than any other person's job, just had a title that was an unusual title. And it had some differences with it, but it was a job. And that was really important for me to remind myself that we never should get hung up on titles, and that when we're in a conversation, even if I got to talk to Trump, you know, I'm going to still offer him respect because he's a person. And that was really powerful for me. And I've thought about that so many times since then, that Bill really gave me that gift that, It's all about the person. So thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Michelle. Oh, I had to ask her 3 or 4 times before she said it right.
Yeah, he did.
My aha moment was when I realized this was not a conversation that journalists were having or a conversation that City Club was having. Librarians, public television, the Black History Museum, the student group at Boise State, the curriculum folks at the Boise School District. I was at a conference for science editors at Boston and MIT last summer, and you could substitute civility for science, and they were having the same conversation. Why aren't people trusting us? Why do they dismiss our facts? Why can't we communicate? And I realized that every level of society is having this very same conversation, and we're not doing a very good job of listening. We're too busy labeling. We're too busy getting ready to make our argument, and we're not listening, and this and it infects every part of our society today.
I want to thank you all for joining us and asking so many good questions. I want to thank Bill Manny, Michelle Chadwick, and Richard Newman for sharing their thoughts. And now I get to do the final City Club thing, which is to hand out the coveted City Club mugs, which are dishwasher safe and 100% civil. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club forum on Wednesday, March 28th, will feature New York Times national security reporter Adam Goldman discussing his experience reporting on the president, spies, and why the truth matters. Learn more at cityclubofboise.org. You can connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.